somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Frit Ord, and the Politiken Foundation. Welcome to another expert opinion on Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech. This is going to be something like the fifth episode that focuses on the Middle Ages, which may be overkill. But frankly, I think that so many things took place in this period that are crucial to understand later and more familiar developments, that this medieval obsession is justified. But if you're ODing on the Middle Ages, rest assured that this is the last episode to focus on that period. More importantly, today's expert is uniquely qualified to give us all an extremely interesting comparative look at heresy and inquisition across medieval Christianity, both Greek and Latin, Islam, and Judaism. Christine Caldwell Ames is a historian of medieval Europe and professor at the University of South Carolina. She's the author of Medieval Heresies, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, which I highly recommend. It's on our webpage and available on Amazon in both paperback and Kindle versions. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's a real honor to have you, Professor Christine Caldwell Ames.
Thank you very much.
You have undertaken the huge job of comparing heresy and inquisition across the three Abrahamic faiths during the medieval period. Very broadly speaking, are there any defining characteristics of heresy that is common to all three religions in this period?
Yes, there are. And first, there is the agreement that there are such things as heresy and orthodoxy that have really permanent consequences. And that seems obvious, but it is important to point out. And while the ability of all three religions to police heresy is really different, for example, in this period, Jews don't have a state, they do all conclude that there is such a thing as right and wrong belief. But at the same time, and this is really important to recognize, there's frequent or even constant negotiation, conversation, and even disagreement about what constitutes heresy and orthodoxy. So one commonality is that those who are called heretics in all three faiths, they believe that they're the ones who have gotten it right, that they're the orthodox, and that it's their opponents who are the real heretics. And second, in terms of the people and the groups that are called heretics, what I think unites all three religions is the question of how scriptures and traditions are to be understood and interpreted. And this is really the locus for heresy in all three faiths. These scriptural religions always embed uncertainty, interpretation, and in part because they were written at a particular moment in historical time. But of course, time moves on, and those texts and traditions have to be adapted, understood in those different circumstances. How do believers figure out really how to balance scripture and tradition in a different moment, in a different circumstance? For example, a question that I ask my undergraduate students in my History of Christianity class is this. According to the New Testament, is it Christian to post on Instagram? How might you find out the answer to that question? How could you know that? Again, what sources do you go back to? Obviously, there's no clarity, right? There's no specific reference to Instagram in the New Testament. How does someone figure that out? And again, that is such a locus, I think, for tension, for, again, disagreement. And so it's in both really interpreting texts and traditions and authorities and then really applying them within a specific context that we see accusations of heresy in the Middle Ages in Judaism, Islam, and Christianity.
And I guess this is also why this topic becomes so hugely important for what we in our modern age call freedom of conscience and freedom of expression, because it very much has to do with what you say, how you understand a text, and therefore how you police thought and expression.
Absolutely. And that's what I think is something that is important to remember about the Middle Ages, is that we do have individuals, say, with different levels of education, different levels of learning, different levels of engagement with their scriptures and traditions. But we have individuals who are trying to make their own decisions about how to interpret their faith, how to understand their faith, and how to live out their faith. And as much as we might think of the Middle Ages, especially in the Latin West, as a time of control, and that definitely is the case, we still see that struggle by individuals to figure things out and really construct their religion, their religious belief, their religious behavior for themselves. And that is, again, a moment of tension. It does become, as you say, about conscience and how that conscience is lived out.
So in the podcast, I've tried to cover the question of heresy and Inquisition in medieval Islam, at least in the East, in the Abbasid Caliphate, and also in the Latin West. But I have neglected the Byzantine Empire, although we have in the podcast mentioned Justinian's pretty draconian religious laws building on top of the Theodosian Code. But it seems like these codes sort of made the ground fertile for persecution in the Christian East.
Oh, absolutely. From the various early conversations about heresy at the beginnings of Christianity, really in an embryonic Christianity, the Greek East starts talking about heresy and it never stops. And what is striking then is that, of course, once the church in the East can discipline and punish heresy after the conversion of the Roman emperors to Christianity in the 4th century, it doesn't stop. And so we have those several centuries in the early Middle Ages in which concerns about heresy are pretty dormant in the Latin West, but in the Greek East, both emperors and different kinds of clerics, they are condemning, pursuing, persecuting different kinds of heretics and heresies. And so one significant difference, I think, between the Latin West and the Greek East is that in Byzantium, curbing heresy is overtly understood as being the bailiwick of the emperor. It's his task, a God-given task. So while from the medieval Greek church, that is from ecclesiastics, we see polemics against heresy, accusations of heresy, and in Byzantium, it is heresy that we call dualist, belief, say, in two competing gods. We see general agreement that whether it's through military force or arrests or executions, it is the Byzantine emperor who has that God-given authority and a mandate to ensure the purity of the Orthodox faith. And by that, I mean both capital O, right, Greek Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, as well as little o, Orthodox faith. So what I think, though, is interesting is that we see an uptick in the persecution of heresy in, say, the late 11th century in Byzantium under emperors from the Komneni dynasty. But we don't subsequently see, and I think this is for a few reasons, the widespread institutionalized persecution of heresy in the Greek East as we do start to see in the Latin West.
So no equivalent of the papal tribunals, inquisitorial tribunals, that would sort of permeate Europe in the West later on?
No, we just don't see it. And again, I think this is for different reasons, but we go back to that responsibility of the emperor. It simply just leads to, I think, a different construction of how trials take place.
You mentioned it a bit yourself. So both in medieval Islam and in the Byzantine Empire, you have sort of on-off persecution and concerns with heresy in the early Middle Ages. But in the Latin West, this does not seem to be the case to the same extent. But was it a case that there was no issue of heresy from the 7th until the 11th century, or was it just a small matter?
Yeah, it's not that there's no issue. We always see sort of a couple of little kind of moments. And the big instances of heresy in this period from the 7th century to the 11th is we have the case of the so-called heresy of adoptionism in Iberia. And this is a belief that Christ was adopted by God in historical time. So he didn't always exist. And this is an affair of heresy that becomes involved with the political ambitions of Charlemagne's Carolingian Empire and his political ambitions in Iberia. There's a Eucharistic controversy, an argument over the Mass, how it is that bread and wine becomes Christ's body and blood. There's an argument over the theology of the Eucharist that takes place between two monks in France, Radbertus and Rotremnes, who argue over this. And there's the case of a German monk, Gottschalk of Orbay, who I think is really fascinating, who believes in double predestination. He advocates this idea that all humans are predestined by God for damnation or for salvation. And I'll just point out, any, say, Calvinists or Presbyterians who are listening, this idea of double predestination is very familiar to you. But it is not mainstream, certainly. It is not orthodox when Gottschalk of Orbay is preaching it. And he is punished for this. His books are burned. And so we have these instances. But what is significant about these instances in this period in the Latin West is they're very high-level theological arguments. Again, among sort of upper echelon ecclesiastical types, it's not popular dissent, it's not a popular movement. And also in the cases that I just mentioned, it involves kings as well. So again, it's a very different kind of conversation. And certainly in terms of sheer numbers, the numbers of accusations, the number of cases that we have between the 7th and the 11th century, it's just not comparable to, again, the preoccupation that we start to see later in the period in the Latin West. Preoccupation in a mental sense, in terms of how much concern and worry we start to see among Latin clerics, but also preoccupation in terms of the activity that we start to see against heresy really beginning in the 12th century.
It's also interesting, as I understand it at least, that there seems to be a theological emphasis on persuasion over persecution in the Latin West, at least among some in this period, that's going to change later on. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. And there are a lot of historians who make this as a historical argument of progression, right? That first, what the church tries to do in the Latin West is persuade. And when persuasion doesn't work, then the church moves on to coercion. And I think there's a lot of reason to say this. But one of the things to point out, and I think this is in some ways obvious, but we tend to forget it. Persuasion is cheaper. Persuasion is easier. Persecution is really difficult. It takes a lot of resources. It's expensive. It demands a buy-in by lay people, a buy-in by secular rulers like kings and counts that persuasion simply doesn't. Persuasion generates hostility and opposition, and this is something certainly we see in the case of the medieval Inquisition. One of the things I think we might think about with persecution is that there's really a risky and uncertain ROI, sort of return on investment. Persecution is a risk. And that's one of the reasons why I think persuasion is so valuable. But more importantly, and this is something else I think we tend to forget when talking about the medieval Inquisition, there is a biblical mandate for persuasion and forgiveness. And medieval Latin clerics did take this seriously. We have several New Testament texts that emphasize the ministry of correction. Christians are told to correct their erring brothers in a spirit of gentleness and reconciliation. For example, we see this in Matthew 18. And this mandate helped to structure discipline throughout the medieval Latin church, and it did extend to lay heretics as well. Now, what I think is interesting when we start to see coercion develop and succeed persuasion is that a correction biblical text like Titus 3:10, which says, okay, you try to correct your erring brother, you try to tell him he's wrong, but if he doesn't listen, he then has condemned himself. You can let him go. He is one who has damned himself. A text like this, which is a correction text, is eventually used to support Inquisition and even to execute heretics by, in effect, saying, well, the person who is self-condemned is, in effect, condemned, and you don't have to worry about him anymore. But I would stress again that clerics do take this biblical mandate seriously, even if eventually it will lead them to Inquisition.
I think that's extremely interesting how the interpretation of scripture changes. So the same place, say Matthew chapter 3, verse 12, I think is the wheat and the chaff, is in one period interpreted as you should let God ultimately punish and burn the heretics. And then it later becomes interpreted as, you know, actually we have to burn heretics ourselves.
Yeah, that's a great observation. And I think it's so significant in our understanding of medieval Inquisition that churchmen, inquisitors, they are going to the Bible. But what they are but these texts are supple, right? These texts are in some ways flexible. They have multiple meanings. They can be interpreted differently in different historical contexts. They can be interpreted differently based upon need, right? Desire, in a sense, what one wants to see there. This is something that we see with persecution. And so, as you say, the text on the wheat and the tares, which is repeated so often in ecclesiastical texts on heresy and inquisition, the question is, are you going to emphasize the wheat, sort of saving what is good, or are you going to emphasize the chaff? Are you going to emphasize getting rid of what is bad? And we really do see a shift in medieval Latin interpretation and use of that text. And it's so important because either way, there's a biblical foundation, right? It's just a question of what biblical foundation, in a sense, you're looking for.
Exactly. And this brings us, of course, into one of sort of the big questions about this period. R.I. Moore's famous thesis about the persecuting society. If I understand Moore correctly, he puts a lot of emphasis on how groups within the top ranks of the church, but also among secular rulers, invented heresies to ensure their own power. But I sense that you think that we should take the religious text and the interpretations offered by these people themselves more seriously. Or am I reading you wrong?
Well, I think what I would say is that I absolutely believe that Moore's thesis of a persecuting society is correct. The spike in heresy accusations and condemnations that we begin to see in the High Middle Ages, it is inarguably tied to the growth of both state and church as really ambitious institutions that document, they track, they ultimately seek to control as many people as they possibly can. And I agree that this spike arises because there are people committed to those institutions who see them, who see state and church and their ability to persecute as avenues for their own personal power. I think that's true. And Moore might reject this particular interpretation, but I believe that his thesis explains really brilliantly how modern states operate as well as how medieval ones did. But what I would say in terms of religious belief, I think that my arguments about religious belief are simply adding another tone to Moore's thesis. I think just adding an additional texture, which helps give it more, I won't say nuance, but again, just a different aspect, a different component of how it is that people arrived at persecution. And the way that I think about it is multiple motivations coexist for human behavior, right? And ignoble motivations coexist with very noble ones. And often, of course, the noble ones help to justify the ignoble ones. And we might think of, say, a modern bad apple police officer who seizes upon a petty traffic infraction to exert disproportionate power upon a driver, but he might sincerely believe at the same time that he is, say, keeping the road safe, right, while he's doing so. And likewise, those clerics who built their own power through persecuting heresy, I don't think that they intentionally called people heretics whom they sort of quote-unquote knew not to be heretics. Accusations of heresy weren't completely random. They're not completely relative. Rather, I think that clerics approached religious difference or disobedience in a way that really redefined and branded it as dangerous heresy, part of a satanic conspiracy that was visible as old as creation. Now, what I think is important to remember in thinking about Moore's thesis of a persecuting society is that sincere religious belief could accompany, and it could even justify, severe and really violent persecution in large part, again, because of those biblical justifications that we just alluded to in talking about the wheat and the tares. That medieval churchmen, they looked back at the Bible, they looked back at earlier authorities like popes and earlier statements of councils. They went back repeatedly to interpret and reinterpret lots of different things. They engaged with those texts, they thought about their meanings, and persecution is no different. that when Christian churchmen began to accuse and to persecute heretics widely, those biblical warrants existed for it. And not just say something like the wheat and the tares, which could be a little bit more ambivalent, but something, for example, like the Apostle Peter, who strikes down dead Ananias and Sapphira. And this is an instance, right, of sort of an apostle who himself is punishing someone through death. And so I'd stress that it's not just that we have clerics sort of finding excuses after the fact, it's that the Bible helps them to decide to persecute in the first place. So I guess one more thing I would say about adding religious belief to the more thesis, which I do think, again, is really important. When we incorporate religious belief into his thesis of persecution, is we can see how churchmen really sincerely sought internal agreement and change, as well as external conformity when they pursued heretics. They explicitly frame this in Christian terms. If you don't sincerely regret your heresy, God will see into your soul. He'll know the truth, even if you can kind of cover and dissimulate and dissemble now in front of an inquisitor. Eventually God will know and will punish you. And so these persecuting institutions in the Middle Ages, they wanted internal as well as external capitulation. And so I would say that that's a really ambitious conception of the kind of power that R.I. Moore was talking about. Again, not just external, but also internal. And something else, I think this is also really modern, right? The idea that you don't just want external conformity, you want a sincere change of heart, a sincere acceptance, and almost re-education. And so again, I think that this just gives us a sort of different sense of the kind of power that Moore is talking about in that thesis.
Yeah. And talking about sort of modernity with the establishment of what is perhaps a bit misleadingly called the medieval Inquisition, starting, I guess, from 1231 with the papal appointment of inquisitors around Europe, the methods they developed are, you know, strikingly modern in many ways, sort of emphasizing legal procedure, meticulous records, interrogation techniques that are being used around the world by intelligence services and police forces today. Why was it that the medieval Inquisition in the Latin West became so much more organized and pervasive than in the East and in Islam? You alluded to it a bit before when we talked about the Byzantine East, but what were the different dynamics in play?
That's a good question, because one of the open questions to me, or I guess one of the sort of counterintuitive things, is that the Greeks and Latins have a common heritage in Roman law. And this is what makes it a little bit harder to understand why the inquisitorial method to combat heresy becomes so much more common, so much better developed in the Latin West than it did in the Greek East. I think that the explicit mandate that the papacy gave Latin bishops in 1184 to investigate their flocks, right? We have a specific text that says, go out and find them, right? This is your episcopal charge. Go out and find them, seek them out, talk to the community. I think this is one reason why we have a development in the Latin West. We don't see that same kind of instruction in the Greek East. I think the deployment of the mendicant orders, the Dominicans and the Franciscans as legates who are expressly deputed by the popes, again, go out, conduct heresy inquisitions, be flexible, walk around. This is another reason. As you said, the role of the Byzantine emperor as the protector of orthodoxy and even the character of Byzantine monasticism, it just doesn't generate the kind of personnel that we get in the Latin West who can go out and carry on these investigations very efficiently, very easily, very flexibly. And something else that we might not think of that I also think is significant in distinguishing the Latin West and its sophistication with Inquisition, as opposed to what we see in the Greek East, is the development of a penitential theory and practice in the Latin West that is based upon questions, that is based upon almost interrogation. Again, the idea in the Latin West that when a cleric is speaking to a penitent, a layperson, there is that drawing out of the sin, who, what, when, where, why. We see this very self-consciously thought about and practiced in the Latin West, and I do believe it has a significant influence on inquisitorial practice. And again, we don't see something comparable in the Byzantine East. And finally, and this is something else I think we tend not to think about, is how much inquisitorial development of the institution goes hand in hand with the development of European states and the church, who are themselves growing more sophisticated, more managerial in the 13th century. Now, we're used to thinking that in terms of the Moore thesis, right? That basically all of these institutions are getting better at documenting and keeping track of people and asking questions, and that this is significant in the growth of Inquisition in the West. But the other side of that coin is so important in terms of thinking about the Greek East. In the 13th century, right, the Byzantine Empire, the Byzantine Church, it is fragmented, it's in exile, and then it will be struggling to reconstitute itself after the Fourth Crusade in 1204, in which the Latins conquer Constantinople. So we have in the 13th century a Latin West that is rising, becoming more sophisticated, and Inquisition does as well. But in the 13th century in the Greek East, in a sense, both empire and church are struggling. And Inquisition is a tool for strong states. Inquisition isn't a tool for failing states. And I think that this really makes a difference. And then in terms of Islam, what I think is funny is that Islam, in a sense, is a lesson to us that Inquisition actually isn't that sophisticated in a way. That is what we see in medieval Islam, right, is certain jurists, certain rulers who move towards what looks like Inquisition almost reflexively, right? Like there isn't the heritage of Roman law that we have in the West that gives us Inquisition as a legal method. But what we have with some Muslim polities is they develop almost this intuitive sense, right? That one can ask about the faith, right? You establish right belief, you ask people what they believe, and then they punish wrong belief. In this sense, it's sort of a reminder that Inquisition isn't rocket science, right? You can ask questions about belief. And so, for example, in the Muslim Inquisition that we seem to have in the mid-9th century in Baghdad, when the Abbasid Caliph al-Ma'mun orders the examination of people on the question of whether the Quran is created or not, these trials, they're not based on Roman law, right? They're not based on inquisitorial manuals. They're not based on legal responsa. It's just asking questions about belief. It's just inquiring in the way that we see in Inquisition, right? An Inquisition is an inquiry. And so I think the simple answer really in terms of why we don't see the same thing in medieval Islam is, again, this diffuse nature of religious and political power in the Muslim world. It's too decentralized, too diffuse to really permit the development of Inquisition as an institution as we see it in the West.
I wonder, what about the establishment of universities? Clearly, Dominicans were prevalent at universities in Paris and Bologna. And so on the one hand, the universities helped spread reason and inquiry. But on the other hand, might they also have contributed to the power of the Inquisition because these were brilliant, highly intelligent people who were educated at these universities?
That's true. And one of the things that I think is a connection is that, say, inquisitorial manuals, they are structured in many ways in a spirit of rationalism, right? They are structured logically. They are gesturing towards, I think, a university model of order, again, and asking questions and how do you ask questions? How do you answer questions? But at the same time, what we see with the people who are deputed to become inquisitors, again, especially those Dominicans and Franciscans, it's not the university masters. It's not the people who are well-trained in theology. One of the standard arguments for why Dominicans especially used to be the personnel conducting inquisitions was that this was an order dedicated to preaching, teaching, and pastoral care, and particularly its interest in theology. The idea that, again, they are trained in theology, they are the ones who go out into communities and say, this is what you should believe, right? This is what's right belief. I actually don't think that's an accurate reflection of what the Dominicans did when they were inquisitors and why they were good inquisitors in the first place. I think of someone like Bernard Guy, who is one of our most famous, one of our most notorious inquisitors, right? You have mentioned him before. He's played by F. Murray Abraham in the movie version of The Name of the Rose. He's not a trained theologian. He is someone who has a little bit of education, but he is dedicated to the procedure of Inquisition. He's read a lot of inquisitorial texts. Again, the literature about Inquisition that begins to circulate. But he's not someone who is familiar with the university. He is not in that world. He's from really the world of the Dominican studia, the local schools. And so I think that even though there is a connection in terms of a sort of flavor of, again, how do we ask questions? What do we look for? How do we teach people? How do we go back to law? How do we understand legal texts? How do we understand earlier papal statements? I think the connections between a sort of university rationalism and inquisitorial practice are actually much weaker than we used to think that they were.
Quite an impact when, say, you're living in a small town in the southern France, and then suddenly Bernard Guy or one of his colleagues show up and put on the whole inquisitorial show. Do we have a good sense of how the medieval Inquisition affected what we today would call freedom of thought, freedom of religion, freedom of expression in these communities where the inquisitors were most active?
We do. And again, I think that's a terrific question, especially in terms of understanding what the medieval experience can tell us about our modern understandings of these concepts. What we see certainly at the beginning of Inquisitions, say in the 1230s, they are really haphazard. It's as if the DMV people were coming to your town, right? People are trying to sort of figure out, again, what is supposed to happen here, what is procedure. Everything is evolving in such a messy way. And we do see resistance from lay communities at the very beginning. And this makes sense, right? It makes sense. An inquisitor comes to the town, again, a local Dominican, you know, as you say, someone like Bernard Guy, and the senses of an outsider, right, coming in. And so in the first few decades of the 13th century, when we start to see inquisitions take place in locales, there, I think, isn't as much of an effect on the behavior of people as we do start to see. This is something that the medieval historian Mark Gregory Pegg has spoken about, the way in which the inquisitorial presence after a while, and he talks about a long-term inquisition in the middle of the 1240s, how it is that people, it's not just that inquisitors redefine the behavior, the actions, the speech that they are told about. And they do this, right? They do redefine it. They do understand it as heresy. They do rebrand it. But what we see eventually is that communities themselves do start to adapt. I think one of the best examples of this is really a wonderfully fascinating Inquisition that takes place in the 1300s, the early 1300s, by a bishop in France, a bishop of Pamiers, Jacques Fournier, who conducts inquisitions for a very long time, several years, from about 1318 to 1325. And he investigates hundreds of people. And what we see in those depositions is exactly this: fear among communities, fear to talk to people who might be suspected, fear to talk to people that they know are heretics, people who have embraced dualism, fear of being seen, fear of speaking. And again, this is something we see over and over again in the interrogations that Jacques Fournier performs. People who report, "I didn't want to see him. I didn't want people to know that I knew him. I tried to avoid him." And so we do see, in terms of statements, in terms of actions, we see self-censorship, we see attempts to hide things. And what I do think is so remarkable about those depositions, the word fear recurs over and over again. Fear of the inquisitors, fear of neighbors, fear of heretics. It's really remarkable in terms of how that institution, however messy, again, messy and unsuccessful, it seems to be at the beginning, but after decades really does reshape how people think and act and express themselves.
I don't know if you've seen the movie The Lives of the Others.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
About East Germany and the role of the Stasi. You feel sometimes that it's the medieval equivalent of that, sort of really probing into your lives and making you distrust your closest because you never know who says what.
Well, you know, that's an interesting comparison because, of course, what we see in that film, right, it's the person who is also doing the listening who then begins to sort of question himself and think about his involvement in these lives and in a sense reflect on what it means to be the listener, the person who is investigating. And one of the questions for me that is so fascinating is Jacques Fournier is in that position, right, as other inquisitors are. And we certainly don't have any kind of reflection, right, by Jacques Fournier about how I feel about investigating everyone else's lives. But there is, again, I think we see from someone like Fournier, someone like Bernard Guy, again, a sense of zeal that this detail is necessary. Again, the detail is an exertion of power. It absolutely is. But the sense here that ultimately the saving of the soul is paramount. And maybe that's giving them too much credit, but I do think that that is part of the dynamic that we're talking about with the medieval Inquisition.
All right. I thought it was very interesting that you included Judaism in your book, because when we think of heresy and Inquisitions, we often think in terms of a majority persecuting a minority, and for good reasons. But Jews were living as minorities in both medieval Islam and Christendom, and they didn't have a state of their own. So they didn't have a state apparatus that they could use to sort of define and enforce orthodoxy. But you show that even within the minority, ideas of heresy were prevalent. Can you expand on that and also how Jews tried to enforce heresy when they had no state apparatus?
Sure. Policing heresy within Jewish communities was difficult to impossible, whether they lived under Christian or Muslim rule, and it's for precisely the reason that you cite. But what is interesting is that even without a state and without any centralized ecclesiastical structure, there are nevertheless, right, vibrant and contentious conversations about what is heresy, what is orthodoxy among Jews throughout the medieval period. And Jews do accuse other Jews of heresy. So as you say, and I think this is really important to recognize and to emphasize, accusations of heresy are made by minorities as well as by majorities in the Middle Ages, right? Again, just to repeat, it is not just majority against minority. And one of the reasons why I think this makes perfect sense is that if we recall that the very first accusations of heresy, those are made by a minority. Those are made by illegal Christians living in the Roman Empire against each other, right? This is the origin of heresy. It is an accusation of a minority against itself. And so in that sense, it's not unusual, right, that this is something we see among Jewish communities in the Middle Ages living, again, under Muslims and Christians. So the most visible tool for attempted enforcement of orthodoxy in medieval Jewish communities is the ban, the harem, which Jewish communities could impose upon teachings and people that they understood or wanted to accuse of heresy. What we also glimpse, just occasionally, but it's really fascinating, we also glimpse Jewish communities who appealed to their Muslim or Christian rulers to manage internal Jewish heresy, to impose force, or even say to burn books that are understood to be heretical, that are accused of being heretical. So what I would emphasize, though, is this lateral nature of heresy accusations within medieval Judaism. That is, we're talking about rabbis, scholars who are accusing other rabbis and scholars, or say the communities that we call rabbinite, that is mainstream Jewish communities who are accusing other communities known as the Karaites, that is, Jews who reject the oral law. So we have, again, sort of lateral accusations rather than what we see more so in Latin Christianity or Islam, more so kind of top-down accusations. That is, again, especially in the Latin West, accusations made by those above to those below. Again, it is absolutely a conversation within a community, accusations of heresy within the community.
A very interesting person is the Jewish thinker Maimonides. I think you basically credit him with creating a sort of Jewish orthodoxy and heresy, and also support some pretty harsh penalties. But very interestingly, he himself fell foul both of Muslim rulers at times, but also his fellow Jews. So can you tell us more about who Maimonides was and why he became so important?
Yes, and he really is fascinating for the history of heresy. He's fascinating for lots of reasons, but he's so important for, I think, our bigger comparative story of heresy in the Middle Ages. Now, Maimonides, he's born in Muslim Iberia in 1138, and he will die in Muslim Egypt in 1204. And he's this brilliant polymath. He is a philosopher. He is a doctor. He lived under both Muslim and Christian rule. He lives both in the West and in the East. He writes in Hebrew as well as Arabic. And what's significant about Maimonides, I think, for the history of heresy, he's not the first person to craft a list of Judaism's principles of belief. Earlier, a man called Sadia Gaon had done so. One of these Karaites, a man called Judah Hadassi, had already done so. But Maimonides issues a list, I should say writes a list, of 13 principles of Judaism that is significant, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is that he is enormously prestigious in diaspora Judaism. Again, he's controversial, as you allude, and I'll mention that in a second. But he does have this great prestige of, as a thinker, as a leader among fellow Jews. But the list is also significant because of his insistence that observing these principles is what makes someone a good Jew. And violating these 13 principles of belief makes someone a bad Jew who could be licitly punished. And again, he does refer, as you say, to some harsh penalties. He makes an allusion to the death penalty for violation of these
principles. Almost a parallel to Al-Ghazali and his Incoherence of the Philosophers, where he also sets out sort of three no-nos that takes you beyond the pale and makes you an apostate in medieval Islam.
That's a very good comparison, I think. And one thing to keep in mind, certainly about Maimonides, is that this is part of a theoretical discussion, right? And this is perhaps one difference, certainly, with the Muslim context of the same thing, right? These are principles of belief, and these are the no-nos, and if you were outside, you can be punished. Maimonides, of course, has no power to punish anyone, right? Medieval Jews don't have the ability to impose the death penalty. And so this is absolutely important to keep in mind, that when Maimonides is saying these are principles of belief and there can be harsh penalties for violating them, nobody has to agree with him, right? His fellow Jews don't have to agree. And certainly we would expect that a lot of his fellow Jews didn't agree. And there is this conversation, how is it that we can, again, enforce heresy in an environment in which we don't have our own state? But what I do think is so fascinating about Maimonides and his 13 principles is also he's in this 12th century context, right? He is talking about persecution, however theoretical it might be. And so I guess to me, one question is, Did everybody just get more persecutory in the 12th century? Right? Does everybody just, in effect, whether they're Jews or Muslims or Christians, do we just start seeing greater harshness in the 12th century? Is Maimonides sort of an instance of that? And something else about Maimonides, as you said, he himself is controversial, especially after his death. He becomes controversial in some quarters because he is seen as a rationalist. He is seen to depend upon logic over tradition. He is interested in allegorical interpretation. And very famously in the 1230s, a controversy breaks out among rabbis in France and Iberia. after one rabbi, Solomon ben Abraham, he proposes a ban on studying the teachings of Maimonides. And it's even reported that Solomon appeals to Christian authorities. And he says, please go ahead and burn the books of Maimonides. These are heretical. And we see the development of two factions, two rabbinic factions in Southern Europe, sort of pro-Maimonides and anti-Maimonides. And so what I think is really interesting is that he's kind of a live by the sword, die by the sword sort of example. Maimonides constructs this list that we might take as being a kind of Jewish orthodoxy, even if, again, nobody had to agree with him. But to others, he himself seems to be dangerously heretical.
Okay, I want to move on to the Spanish Inquisition, which is different from what we call the medieval Inquisition, but nonetheless related, and which is at the end of the medieval era. I think it would still be good for us to touch a bit more upon why and how it was established, and why also it has become perhaps the most infamous of the Inquisitions.
This is something that is always fun to talk to my undergraduate students about, because as Americans, they are used to thinking of Ferdinand and Isabella, the king and queen of Spain, as being the patrons of Christopher Columbus. And it's always fun to talk to my students about the fact that Ferdinand and Isabella, the Catholic monarchs, the so-called Catholic monarchs, that they are the founders of the Spanish Inquisition. Again, something that perhaps doesn't get as much press among American students as the patronage of Columbus. So what is important to know about the Spanish Inquisition? Again, it is founded by King Ferdinand, who had been King of Aragon, and Queen Isabella, who had been Queen of Leon Castile. And they will marry in 1469. They eventually combine their realms into what we will start to call the Kingdom of Spain. And one thing that's interesting is that Aragon had a history of inquisitions, but Castile really didn't. But Ferdinand and Isabella become concerned, so they say, about conversos, that is, Jews who had converted to Christianity in earlier waves of evangelism and even anti-Jewish violence in Iberia. And so Ferdinand and Isabella, they found the Spanish Inquisition in 1478 to pursue these conversos who are suspected by them of backsliding, that is, returning to Judaism in beliefs or practices, for example, Christians who converted from Judaism who are still refusing to eat pork. And what is important then in thinking about the difference between the Spanish Inquisition and the medieval Inquisitions that had preceded it, the Spanish Inquisition is an arm of the state. Medieval Inquisitions were an arm of the church, but the Spanish Inquisition, even though it is carried out by churchmen, but it is churchmen who in effect have been employed by the state to initially pursue these conversos. And the Spanish Inquisition, it, like most institutions, it becomes self-perpetuating. It never finishes its work, right? It moves from these conversos, eventually it expands its purview to Protestants, to mystics, and also to converted former Muslims, that is, people known as Moriscos. And so I think that one of the reasons why the Spanish Inquisition does become infamous, much more so than medieval Inquisitions, is because high and low culture can latch onto it. Its cruelty can be more popularly depicted. And think, for example, of Francisco Goya, who paints pictures of the Spanish Inquisition, and Edgar Allan Poe, right, who writes The Pit and the Pendulum, a story of Inquisition. And because the Spanish Inquisition lasted until 1834, it coexisted, certainly long after printing, right? Domestic art, the rise of the novel in the West. And so the Spanish Inquisition was more efficient than the medieval Inquisition. It inherently had that secular support, that state support that medieval trials sometimes had trouble getting. It tortured more, it executed more. But I think it's also that the Spanish Inquisition, it coexisted with a kind of popular culture, with modern culture. And I think that's significant as well in making its excesses so known, so notorious. Again, the development of what we call sometimes the black legend of the Spanish Inquisition, it just becomes sort of, it looms so large in a sort of mentality of the West. It becomes the other when notions of toleration begin to develop in Europe, right? The Spanish Inquisition is the bad example, which is so important in those conversations about, say, political theory, theory of toleration. And something else I would add for why it becomes so infamous is that the Spanish Inquisition, unlike the medieval Inquisition, it isn't an Inquisition of the Americas. It takes place in the Americas, and I think that that plays a role as well.
The backdrop to the Spanish Inquisition and the expulsion of Spanish Jews in 1492 is the Christian reconquest of Spain from Muslim rule going back to the 8th century. And of course, there were also Jews living under Muslim rule in Spain at the time. There has been a tendency among some writers and some historians to sort of sharply contrast the Spanish Inquisition with medieval Islamic Spain, which is sometimes portrayed as a place of interreligious harmony and tolerance based on this concept of convivencia, or living together. But it seems to me that things were a bit more complicated than that, and that at least the tolerance in Muslim Spain is a pretty far cry from modern notions of tolerance and religious freedom.
Yeah, I think that things were much more complicated than that. Absolutely, I think that is absolutely true. And the distinction, as you point out, is very often between a sort of golden age of the convivencia, the living together of three religions, and especially, again, the golden age of Jews who are living in Muslim Spain versus what will happen in the Latin West. And what is fascinating, I think, is that historians have argued exactly this point, and it's a really troubled one, I think, as well as being an interesting one. Is it fair to say that medieval Jews who lived under Islam had it better than medieval Jews living under Christian rule? Because some people have argued that this is maybe a reverse of the state of things today in terms of Jewish communities living as minorities. I do think that if we're generalizing, sort of putting in that warning, life for Jews in Muslim Spain in the early Middle Ages was, in fact, better than life for Jews in the Latin West.
Lewis and Cohen have both sort of said, that there wasn't the sort of the mass persecution of Jews that would happen later on in the Latin West.
And that's true. We don't see the sort of sophistication. We don't see the sort of structural persecution. We also don't see the kind of popular sort of local violence that we see against Jews in the Latin West. We don't see that so much in the Muslim world. Now that said, what is important to remember is that for both Jews and Christians who are living as minorities, whether it's in Muslim Spain or the Muslim East, there is a suspicion when they become too successful. That is, when we do start to see Jews and Christians who are rising socially and politically, there is backlash to that in Muslim polities. This is true. We see, again, accusations of sort of taking advantage, but again, sort of issuing that sort of this big generalization. In the Muslim world, Jews are able to have more stability. I think that is fair to say. Again, the communities themselves can be more stable. They can have a kind of political and cultural and social success in the Muslim world that we simply don't see. We also don't see that turn, again, that turn that Moore identifies, right? That in the High Middle Ages, things start to get clearly worse for Jews living in the Latin West, in the Christian Latin West. We don't see something comparable in the Jewish communities in Islam. But again, what I think is important is just reminding us that the big generalizations are hard to make, right? And they're rarely a good idea in interpreting history, right? Context matters. This is something that the historian David Nuremberg has talked about in terms of Muslim and Jewish communities living in Christian Spain, right? Again, what happens on the ground? What happens in the street? How these relationships are so complicated. But what is the crucial point, and you've said it, and it's so worth restating, is that even the best of situations, right, for Jewish communities, really for any religious minority in the medieval world, even the best of situations is so different from what we in the modern West understand to be tolerance and freedom in terms of religious beliefs, religious behaviors, and religious identity.
It's basically a submissive status where you're tolerated but subject to respecting the superiority of the majority, in this case, the Muslims, when we're talking Muslim Spain. So here you also see, like you would see in medieval Christendom, sort of regulations on clothing for Jews, for instance.
Well, and I think, yeah, absolutely. And I think that that takes us back to what we were talking about in terms of, say, the presence of the Inquisition in communities, right? How it is that instability causes not only tension, right? Tension in communities, tension in individuals, but how it really restructures and reshapes daily life. And certainly one of the things to keep in mind also about, say, Jewish communities in the Latin West is that over time, they do become, in some sort of strange ways, they become subject to the Inquisition. So it's not just, for example, those conversos. That is, conversos are Christians, right? Former Jews who are now Christians, who are subject to the Spanish Inquisition. But we do see Jewish communities who fall under the aegis of medieval inquisitors. So we that daily tension, again, that daily stress of living as a minority, right? Whatever kind of religious minority it is in the medieval world, it is worthwhile thinking about how that does, again, reshape daily behavior and daily sensibility.
So my last question, are Inquisitions a thing of the past, or you think, or is it something that is still very much relevant in the 21st century?
Oh, Inquisitions are absolutely very much relevant in the 21st century. I wish that weren't true, but as long as we have orthodoxies, we will have Inquisitions. And I think I mean that both in sort of literal but also figurative terms. That is, there will always be, right, suspicion of minority opinions by the majority, the attempt at, say, social exclusion, something we see in the Middle Ages, something that I don't think is foreign to our own experience. We see sort of the kind of small eye, right, questioning suspicion of people and opinions that are different, that are beyond the pale. I do think there are such things as secular orthodoxies, something that you have alluded to before in the podcast. And as long as secular orthodoxies exist, there will be, in effect, low-key inquisitions. What I also think is true is that that power of the state that Moore talks about developing structurally in the Middle Ages, it is fair to say that we see manifestations of that today. That is, again, a sort of capital I Inquisition. We do see occasionally in different ways, right, in diverse ways, the power of states to try to police or chasten unpopular belief and thought. And so whether it, again, is in very informal modes of inquiry and suspicion or more formal ones, I do think that the Inquisition persists today.
Christine Caldwell-Ames, thank you very much for making us a lot smarter on Inquisition, medieval and modern.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.